And there are things we should learn from for what we end up experiencing. Most of us aren't going to be people who have anything to do with a big decision like these people have been. But nevertheless, you never know. You never know because God calls people to do certain things they never wanted to do and never expected to do. And the Bible's full of people like that, from Moses to Jeremiah. So who knows what God calls us to do? But there's been some changes all through history, like there always is. And some of these changes that affected the church were caused by culture. And what does Romans 12 tell us? Not to conform to the culture, but we do so anyway. And some of it was caused by church leaders, not all of whom did what they should have done. So the whole story is very complicated. And even though today I'm going to make a few comments which are sort of general and maybe in some ways too black and white, remember it's always more complicated than whatever you read in a history book or experience in any other place. History is not simple. And oftentimes even the general story got it mostly wrong. How many sacraments are there? Well, Augustine said there may be hundreds because they're just sacred signs. God's trying to tell us something through these. He did say that it was an invisible grace transmitted by a that's supposed to be visible form. Okay, well, that's wrong. But something visible transmits something invisible. But he said there could be hundreds of them. And the number of sacraments, as understood by the church throughout history, changed. Nobody really had made an important issue out of it. Peter Damian thought there were 12. Hugh of St. Victor thought there might be 30. But he said, actually, to be a true sacrament, it has to be have to been instituted by Jesus himself. That's a true sacrament. And, of course, most of these that people have come up with, that's not the case for. Some people have proposed that these things should be sacraments, even the coronation of a king. God's doing something when a king is coronated, but we don't tend to call those sacraments today. Nobody does. A number of people thought there were 7, and these aren't the only ones. But this is kind of what carried the day for the Catholic Church. The Didache, though, says there's only 2. And that goes back to before Augustine, to the 1st or 2nd century. The Didache means the teaching of the 12. Basically, it's a document, a manuscript, which is trying to say, what did the apostles teach us about all sorts of things? And in that, it says there's 2. Baptism and the Lord's Supper. And that's what Luther said as well. But then, because Luther said 2, the Council of Trent had to say, no, you're wrong about that also, because you're wrong about everything. And so they declared there were 7, and that's been the official view of the Catholic Church ever since. But I want to ask you a question. Have you ever been to a church that doesn't practice only 2 sacraments? What about foot washing? That was instituted by Jesus. Should foot washing be a sacrament? What do you all think? That's a visible thing that has meaning beyond what getting your feet clean is all about. In fact, I'll tell you, I have a friend, when he was growing up back in Maryland, I'm not sure if it was once a month, I think it was once a month, on a Friday night, they had a foot washing service. And he told me before he went, his mother always made him take a bath and make sure his feet were clean so people would not think he was from, you know, the wrong side of the tracks. But they did this, in this particular church. It was part of a local Bible church movement, which I'm not sure what they are connected to historically. I don't even know if they still do it. But all these different churches have done or continue to do foot washing as a sacrament. So, are we out of line? What do you all think?
with the Lord's Supper, it was stated to give us a remembrance of me.
Yep.
I don't believe that was the case with the first motion.
That's true. Baptism wasn't given as do this in remembrance of me, though. And foot washing was, you've seen what I do, you do it. Isn't that what he said? I think something like that.
Well, you don't see that repeated throughout the New Testament. And really, the Lord's Supper was a culmination of all the sacrifices of the Old Testament, and baptism was a culmination of all the cleansing ceremonies of the Old Testament. So Jesus did something very purposeful there.
That's true. You're right about that, yeah, certainly. And there doesn't seem to be an analogy with foot washing in the Old Testament that we know of, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if we're asking the question, what was conveyed by foot washing, it was the superior humbling himself before the sinful inferior, which is a demonstration of grace. And if that's what is to be communicated, who represents Jesus if we do foot washing today? Because he was God washing the feet of sinful man. Who exactly would represent God in that?
That's very true. But on the other hand, we don't exactly have a problem. I'm sorry, we don't exactly have solved the problem of humility. So lording over other people would be something that people should, it'd be good to learn more about that. And foot washing might be a way to do that.
Yeah, I mean, then we're talking about sanctification.
Yeah, right.
Which should be practiced.
Anyway, I'm not going to answer this today, but just thought it was interesting that all these different churches do or have practiced it recently. But we go on. What about marriage between two people who are the same sex? That's a more recent issue that's come up. Very recent compared to the long period of time talking about a number of sacraments. All these churches say it's okay. That means it's okay to do in their church. Now, excuse me, to be fair to the American Baptists, they don't say it's okay, but they say it's up to the individual church, which basically says it's okay. So all of these are the mainline churches that have been historically part of the United States for the last couple hundred years. All of them say it's okay, except these people say it's not okay. The Orthodox, the Catholics, and the Southern Baptists somehow escaped being part of that. Of course, they were kicked out of they withdrew from the Northern Baptist Church at the time of the Civil War, so they haven't been around as long as the rest of them. But I think that's kind of interesting. We look to our Protestant heritage as being what we're connected to, but actually in this case, we're not connected to it. We're connected to the Catholics. And similarly for this one, do you need to affirm the deity of Jesus to be ordained in the church? I don't know if you know the story of Mansfield Caseman, but he was a man who was in a United Church of Christ church that was, I don't know if I get the story quite right, was like a, maybe he was ordained there, but it was going to be a joint church between Presbyterians and the United Church of Christ. So there are churches like that that have two denominations meeting together. At the same time, it's like one church. And he was asked the question during his ordination, is Jesus God? He said, no, God is God. That erupted into a big controversy because to not affirm that Jesus is God is a big problem. So there was the Presbyterians, of course, as you know, go through a lot of procedure to handle problems like this. And that happened here. It went up to the General Assembly, and they basically said, handle it at the local assembly, at the Presbytery level, which was the Presbytery of the National Capital Region back in Washington, D.C. And at that point, this was proposed. We believe that God came to redeem this world of lost children and to open the way to eternal life through the birth, sinless life. Sinless was added to this. Atoning death. Atoning was added to that. And bodily resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. Bodily was added to that. This motion was defeated by a margin of 2-1. So Manuel Caseman was ordained. And that was the end of it. Now, does that make the Presbyterians all bad? Well, not instantly, but this is the beginning of the road. Actually, not the beginning, but part of the road going downhill to accept someone in your church who doesn't even believe Jesus is divine. But among the Eastern Orthodox, the Roman Catholics, and the Southern Baptists, this is still true. You cannot be ordained in those churches if you deny the deity of Jesus Christ. But you can the other ones. So, when we talk about the Catholics, we have to recognize that on many things, not just these two, they've been strong. If you remember last time we talked about Vatican I, Vatican I is where the Catholics came up and said, the Enlightenment and what its fallout is, we oppose. The Pope said that very strongly. Meanwhile, Protestants kind of went along with a lot of it. And so we have to ask the question, how is it that all these historic Protestant denominations, which none of them are all that old compared to the Catholics, have let these doctrines of infidelity come along? I'm going to talk about a little bit about theological liberalism and how it happened and what people did about it. First of all, there's sort of two movements of the Enlightenment that come together at the same time, not the same time, but sequentially in such a way that the people who got affected by this in the church, you see both of these strands present. First of all, the Enlightenment emphasized human reason and experience over revelation. Revelation used to be the authority for Protestants. For Catholics, it was basically the church, because the church was interpreting revelation. And they kind of elevated that above, as we understand it, revelation itself, because they brought in tradition, which is suspect. Nevertheless, the Enlightenment appealed to people because of the realization. I think you can almost say it's a fallout of the Reformation, when Protestants, instead of having another separate church like the Orthodox did, we split into many churches, which basically we don't agree on certain things, so we split. And you can even look at that at how we understand the Lord's Supper or baptism, and Luther and the other ones could not agree. So basically they're using their own judgment against somebody else's judgment to come to a conclusion which the Bible doesn't really explain in such great detail. The Romantic movement, on the other hand, was a reaction against reason. It was saying, you know, we need to recognize that people, individual people, have a relationship with God or other people that's not just based on signing a document. It's based on their subjective understanding of things. So the Romantic movement brought into the discussion a repudiation of reason as the ultimate judge of what matters. And both of these come together in how theological liberalism falls out. One of the ways they did was looking at the Bible itself. The Bible is an ancient book. And you know, if you look at ancient books in general, who wrote them? There's no copyright. There's often no author mentioned. How do you know it was written by Plato or anyone else? Well, you really don't. And so literary criticism tried to judge whether something was actually written by Plato by comparing all the things allegedly written by Plato to seeing if there is a common style of writing and lots of other things like that to conclude. And after doing that, they decided that some things attributed to Plato, he didn't really write. Somebody else did. Someone else was trying to get credit for writing something, but putting Plato's name on it, thinking that that will make what they wrote more important. And if you look at the Bible, it's also a problem because there's many things in the Bible that tradition says so-and-so wrote that, but we know tradition isn't always right. So who do we trust? And part of this went even deeper than that, which we're not going to go into, but for example, in Genesis, there's two different words for God used, and some people think each of those represent two different versions of, creation, early story of God and man, and they really were brought together by somebody at some point. Someone wrote this one, someone wrote that one. I think they're called P and Q. And the whole Bible is dissected with this form of higher criticism. And I will say one other thing about that before we go on, and that is lower criticism is generally a good thing because that's what helps us figure out whether to follow one manuscript line or another manuscript line when it comes to, say, the New Testament, because there's over 5,000 manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, and they don't agree about everything. But because of lower criticism, we can compare these and do a lot of analysis to see which is the most likely that we should follow. And that's what's been done, and that's why the more modern versions disagree with the King James on certain things, certain passages. For example, in the end of the book of Mark, when it says you can pick up snakes and they won't bite you, that's not in the most faithful manuscripts. And so we put a footnote there for that and say, maybe you shouldn't trust this as actually scripture. Not that it changes anything, but it's just helpful to know. So what this led to was a change in how we view the scriptures. Actually, the people who were doing this began with doubts about lots of things which we think are important, like, is the Bible inerrant in its original documents? In fact, is it inspired? And so these kind of questions led the people who were doing this to basically treat the Bible as a good book, but it's not our authority, and it's full of errors, and so we need to live with it, and that's it. These are some of the men who influenced the Enlightenment thinking on things like this. And I will say, I think Newton's up there not because he was somebody trying to discredit the Bible. Actually, you might know, Isaac Newton spent more time studying theology than he did science. Now, he had some problems in his theology, but it wasn't because he wasn't very convinced that God was the creator and he should follow God. He had trouble with the doctrine of the Trinity, and that's partly because of some of the people he associated with, like Samuel Clarke. Nevertheless, because of what Isaac Newton discovered, people became very confident that man's reason is capable of making all kinds of brilliant discoveries, and there's no limit to where we can go with that. And that was part of the problem of elevating reason above revelation. These theologians were primarily involved in developing what we call theological liberalism. Schleiermacher, Ritzel, and Bultmann. There are many other ones as well. I just pointed out three of them to represent the situation we find ourselves in. The problem here is that most Americans who wanted to go to graduate degrees in theology in the 19th century, they went to Europe. And that's where a lot of this was happening, in Germany. The opportunities in this country were very limited. Harvard had gone the wrong way a long time before. they I don't know where I wrote it here, but they basically got taken over by Unitarians at the beginning of the 19th century, and they didn't offer a doctorate degree until like 1905 or something like that. So, you know, and that was the leading theological school here. But if you were, I mean, theological liberals aren't quite as bad as Unitarians. I mean, maybe they're the same, but they're not officially the same. So these men were not Unitarians. There it is. So in 1914, Harvard began its Ph.D. program. And they'd had the Unitarians running the show for 100 years before that. So basically things changed beginning with the German universities, and then those people that went there to teach in the American seminaries adopted some of those ideas, and pretty soon they're teaching pastors those ideas, and so it's just going downhill from there. And it's important to recognize that people who are adopting these ideas did not come out and say, I don't believe in the deity of Jesus Christ in the pulpit. They never said that. They said lots of things, but they didn't start just denying all the essentials of Christian teaching. What they did claim was that they were preserving and helping us understand what really is the case for these doctrines in our context today. I mean, historical context change. And we must recognize the fact that when the Bible was written, it was written to people of a different era, and cultures were very different from ours. That doesn't mean that nothing that was written there pertains to us, of course, but people have used that as a way to not just explain things in a different context, but to kind of dismiss a lot of things that were understood by the Jews a long time ago. One thing they also did was they redefined terms. Like Schleiermacher said, sin is failing to be completely dependent on God. Now, if you read that and think about it, there's a lot of truth there. What happened in the Garden of Eden? They want to be dependent. No, they want to be independent of God. And that's a problem a lot of us have. We don't want to be completely dependent on God. So he's saying something here that really is true. But that's not the only definition of sin that matters. There's something about God's law and things like that. But basically, Schleiermacher redefined a lot of terms to suit his new way of explaining things, which were not at all consistent with what had been understood in the past. This man was a pastor in Connecticut, and he had trouble with explaining the doctrine of the Trinity, the atonement, conversion itself, in ways that we understand it today. And he was not as far over, you might say, as some of those people, but certainly going down that path. Another man, Rauschenbusch, was a pastor of a Baptist church in New York City, and he was the one who's most famously known for instituting the social gospel and making it a theology of how we should help the poor. Of course, we should help the poor. But reducing the gospel to helping the poor is not the gospel. This man was a Presbyterian pastor. He was very liberal in terms of denying all of these things that we think are important. And he gave a sermon in 1922, titled, Shall the Fundamentalists Win? This was in response to something that happened before that, which I'm going to mention to you, but I'm going to tell you what happened to him first. When that sermon was given, the Presbyterians launched an investigation. And in the investigation, he was going to be in trouble with his ordination. So what did he do? He resigned and became a Baptist. So he escaped getting in trouble with the Presbyterians. But there were other people who were concerned with what was going on. Among them, another Presbyterian pastor who wrote, gave a sermon 2 months later, "Shall Unbelief Win?" And if you look at the history of the Presbyterian Church, there are many more men like this guy than there were of the Fosdick type. But the Fosdick type seemed to be carrying the day in lots of critical things that happened, including the board at Princeton itself. This is the book that was published that Fosdick was reacting to, The Fundamentals, A Testimony to the Truth. This brought together men from all different denominations to write on all different topics. But you have to understand here that a lot of these Presbyterians, like McCartney, did not really think of themselves as fundamentalists. Certainly, Benjamin Warfield did not, but he wanted to contribute to this to explain certain whatever he wrote on as clearly as he could, because this was basically an interdenominational reaction against liberalism, which was more important than whether or not people are dispensational or not. Dispensationalists believe in the deity of Jesus just like Reformed people do. So, you know, you kind of have to pick your battles and also your allies and what you're doing. So those books were mailed to 250,000 pastors, missionaries, all kinds of people like that, all over the country. And they were explaining these sorts of doctrines that you see here. And yet, this didn't have the same effect in the long run. It didn't defeat what was going on the way they had hoped it would. It also tended to go against a lot of things besides liberal theology, including cults and atheism and things like that. Probably the most significant man in this whole battle was Karl Barth. Karl Barth was from Switzerland. He was educated in a German university. These are two of his professors, people who were very much leading the way on liberal thinking. Let me just tell you a couple things that Hermann said. He said, "Faith is a living, personal relationship with God." Well, who can argue with that? But by that he did not mean Jesus Christ, because he thought that mystics see Jesus as a mediator. Well, so do we. No, he's talking about a relationship with God the Father. He's downplaying the role of Jesus. He says Jesus just helps us feel the presence of God. That's all. So you can see there's problems there, even though the first statement that I read sounds okay. And that's how those men operated. Barth became a pastor of a small church after he finished his training. And he was bothered by his professor signing on to the war designs of the German of Germany at World War I, and some of the things that were being said, which didn't strike him as being very biblical. So he decided to open his Bible, which is something they didn't really do very often in these seminaries or graduate schools. And he began reading the book of Romans and realized this is at odds with what I've been taught. This is not what I was taught at all. Liberalism stressed the immanence of God, God present with us. Well, God is present with us. That's important for us to recognize. It emphasized a personal religious experience. That's also important. It's not just believing a set of doctrines. It emphasized the ethics of Jesus. That's important. Emphasize the historical Jesus. But when they say that, they don't really mean what we think. What they mean is, what we read in the Bible, we can't really trust. The Gospels are problematic. There's things in there like miracles. Did Jesus really turn the water into wine? I don't think so. So there became something called the search for the historical Jesus, which was looking for evidence for Jesus' life outside the Gospels and tried to put together some caricature of what he might be or might have been, aside from what the New Testament says. So they're rejecting things that don't seem to fit in with today's society, with what science teaches us. Science teaches us there's no reason to believe in miracles. They didn't understand the Trinity, of course. They didn't understand sin. All these things are being diminished or rejected by these men. Karl Barth said, God is not just immanent with us. He is. It's more important to understand God is transcendent than his immanence, because that's who he really is. He's only immanent because he's decided to reveal himself to us. He said, God is not man writ large. We're made in God's image, but God's just not like a big person of us who's perfect. That's a completely mistaken idea of who God is. We understand less about God than, much less about God than what he's revealed to us. We really don't know much about God. We're finite beings. God is, as Bart said, wholly other. And he said, God has revealed himself fully and perfectly in Jesus Christ. And it's not just as an example for us, not just that Jesus helped the poor or that Jesus was kind and all that, but it's a personal encounter. When Christ meets us, it's one-on-one. It's an experience that we cannot explain often. That's what it means to know who God is. And he said, the Bible is simply a witness to that revelation. In other words, I don't know if he ever said this, because I haven't read everything he wrote. Karl Barth actually wrote his dogmatics, his systematic theology. It's 6 million words, which I think may be about six times as long as the whole Bible. It's massive. And he never finished. But he said, the Bible is a witness to that revelation, a witness to the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. And by that he meant the Bible itself is a bunch of words. If God's not speaking to you through those words, it's not God revealing himself to you. Now this caused consternation with a lot of evangelicals, and it's still an ongoing discussion. But I will say, in terms of what he did with liberalism, Karl Barth was a hero. Another man that came along was Richard Niebuhr. He wrote, the romantic conception of the kingdom of God involved no discontinuities, no crises, no tragedies, no sacrifices, no loss of all things, no cross and resurrection. A God without wrath brought men without sin into a kingdom without judgment through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross. This is what liberalism did. It completely destroyed everything that the Bible teaches. And finally we get to Machen, who's as close to us as anybody in this whole story. He went to seminary at Marburg after finishing at Johns Hopkins in Princeton. And here's what he wrote to his father. Hermann speaks right to the heart, and I have been thrown all into confusion by what he says. So much deeper is his devotion to Christ than anything I have known myself during these past few years. Now, I put this in here because it's important for us to recognize that people who are struggling with this were faced with very charismatic and persuasive teachers and preachers. It wasn't as clear as You don't believe in the deity of Jesus, therefore you're wrong. It wasn't that clear at all. And this man came from a solid background. But this guy, Hermann, almost persuaded him to become a liberal. It was that close. He later taught at Princeton, and he wrote a book called Christianity and Liberalism. Now, if you look at the date of this, 1923, it's the year after the sermon given by Fosdick, Shall Fundamentalists Win? This book, which is still in print today, basically says there's only two approaches here. There's Christianity, and there's everything else. That's liberalism. It's false. It's denying who God really is. It's denying who we really are. It's man trying to work his way up one way or the other to know God or whatever. And this book had a big impact on his own future and led to him leaving Princeton with some other men and starting Westminster Seminary. And he also started the Orthodox Church in 1936. That's another long story. But as a consequence of that, less than a year later, he died. And the consequence was that the Orthodox Church probably did not become what it could have become had he still had lived for another 20 years, which he certainly could have. But he was rather frail. Anyway, that book's still in print if you want to read it today. So, where am I here? Okay. The other thing I wanted to do today was remind us of how the church continued, in spite of the fact that we often look on Roman Catholics as being waylaid and lost. And we can see some of that through hymns that were written before the Reformation. You know, the Christian faith did not begin with the Reformation. It was going along all before that. These hymns are all in our Bible, in our hymn book today. And the numbers over on the right are numbers I came up with approximately how many other hymns these various poets wrote. And some of them I couldn't figure anything out. But all those hymns are in our hymn book. All these are in our hymn book. And these all occur before the Reformation. And all these, and the last bunch, the hymn book doesn't attribute them to anybody in particular. They're not sure. There's over 30 of these, and if you read them, we sing a lot of them, but when we sing them, I think you have to agree that they have as much spiritual depth, as much doctrinal understanding, as much of anything that's really helpful as anything written by Charles Wesley or Isaac Watts or our Irish friends, the Gettys. They really are worth singing today, and that's why they're in the hymn book, I believe. So I think we should remember these when we think about our heritage. Our heritage isn't just with Protestants and the Reformation. If it was just with that, we'd be in trouble. Catholics have helped us in lots of ways. I'm not saying that we are, you know, getting closer to the Catholics, but I hope they get closer to us. Martin Luther's Reformation should have made sense to them. So with that, I'm going to give you your final exam. And as I pass this out, I'll tell you what I used to tell my students when I was teaching math, that I won't see these evaluations until after the final exam. But remember, there's such a thing as a creative change of grade form. If you have any feedback on what happened, I'd be appreciative. I can also talk to you for a little bit more about something else that I think is kind of interesting. Oh, one more. Some other medieval hymn writers that aren't in our hymn book. This guy, Kidman, was the first man to write a hymn in English, in the English language. That happened in the 7th century. I don't know what the hymn is, but there he is. And a minute here, sorry. Someone's trying to call me, but it's coming out my computer, but I don't know how to hang it up. Maybe I can hang it on my phone. There it goes. One other thing I want to tell you, I guess, by way of concluding, is something that happened when I was teaching in Ethiopia. I had them read a essay by Rudolf Bultmann. Rudolf Bultmann is one of these liberals who wrote a book called Kerygma and Myth. Kerygma is referring to the gospel. I think this is instructive for understanding liberalism. How does Bultmann say the New Testament portrays the world? Well, in Colossians and Romans, it's like a three-storied universe. There is heaven above, earth here, and hell beneath. There's supernatural forces. There's angels, demons, miracles, all these kinds of things. What does Bultmann think is the main focus of New Testament preaching? Redemption. Good. What aspects of this preaching does Bultmann find to be unbelievable? The incarnation, the atonement, the resurrection, the ascension, the second coming, and final judgment. He's got problems with all of those. These questions are the ones I gave in my class. Bultmann says the mythical world of the New Testament is obsolete. What does he say we must do to preach the gospel in our modern world? We need to separate the gospel from our preaching, because the gospel, what we want to understand, as it's in the Bible, was given to a world which was, in our understanding, is like a mythical world. So we need to sort of take the mythology out of it and understand the core. What is it really trying to teach us? The reason we have to do this is because we don't understand these biblical myths the way they were presented to the people in the Old Testament and the New Testament, because we live in a scientific world. We've been influenced by a lot of things today that help us move beyond tradition. We can't force people to believe these myths. I mean, after all, we have light bulbs today. We have all kinds of modern things that they didn't have. So he says, modern man doesn't believe in spirits. We don't believe that disease is caused by demonic activity. Miracles are not historical. They're simply psychological or physiological. They're things that we don't relate to today at all. What does Bultmann say about baptism and the Lord's Supper? Modern man can see no connection between physical aspects of these institutions and any spiritual reality. What does he say about death? It makes no sense to see as death as the result of sin. Death is a natural occurrence. Adam's sin had nothing to do with us. What about the atonement? To suggest that one man could pay for the sins of others makes no sense. To even think that one man could be sinless makes no sense. What about the bodily resurrection of Jesus? Again, incomprehensible. But even if it occurred, it makes no sense to think that it has any bearing on our lives. That's Rudolf Bultmann. You can see he's destroying everything in this essay that we believe in. And that's why Machen said there is Christianity and there's liberalism.
Can we go back to that one slide where okay, a little bit more. It was right at the bottom and I didn't get it all read.
That one?
No, I think it's ahead. I mean,
before, earlier?
No, not earlier. Later.
This one?
No, not that one. It had a buck here. No, it's not that one.
I think that's the last one.
It was the one where everybody kind of moaned and groaned.
Well, we're voting on this one.
There's nothing right about
this one.
I don't know if I have.
It was in a box.
Okay, well, I'm not sure if I have any other boxes.
I don't think
This one? Well, that's the statement that the Presbyterians voted on that they defeated.
It wasn't that far back.
Okay. I think that's all.
Wait, go back. Wait. That's the same one. Oh, that's the one. We saw that one.
I think you'll have to let it go, Karen.
No.
You can, you know, I'm a little behind, but all these are supposed to be posted on our website.
Okay.
You can look at all these slides all over again if you want.
Oh, great. Thank you.
And if I was doing this right, I would have had an audio to go along with that, but I blew it more times than I succeeded because I forgot. But.
You mean you're imperfect?
I'm sorry? Yeah. Oh. Anyway, question?
If I remember correctly, the Puritan's writing seems to have overlapped in time with the theological liberalism time. Did their writing have any effect or play a role in helping them to think correctly?
Well, the Puritans, some people call Jonathan Edwards the last Puritan in this country, and he died in 1757. So this is all happening after that. Now, whether or not those men were reading the Puritans is a good question, but I doubt it. Certainly, Puritans have been read all along, but not by people looking for new ideas.
You mentioned Machen and Warfield combating German liberalism entering America. Do you think that the liberalism movement has had a long-lasting effect on the American Christian church?
Well, I mean, it's still going on today. But the thing about, if you look at the historians' understanding of this, Karl Barth did more to defeat the liberalistic trend than anything any one other single person did. That's why he was on the cover of Time magazine. Because he was one of them and realized the error of his ways. But I think the problem here is that none of these denominational leaders decided to reject that. The Southern Baptists were the only ones, and they didn't do it till just recently, and it was kind of close. Because they were going back and forth between having, I don't know what they call their moderator, but they go from a conservative to a liberal, alternating. And then at one point, they had a conservative elected two times in a row. And after that, the liberals lost. And the liberals in the Southern Baptist Convention, I forget what they're called. There's some term they've adopted to sort of say they are kind of still together, but they're the minority there. There's still some of them in that denomination, I know. But in fact, I don't know. I wouldn't say this guy was especially liberal in lots of ways, but there was a Baptist church in our town where we lived in Kentucky, and the pastor of that church did not believe in a literal Adam and Eve or a literal Noah. But as neo-Orthodox people say, well, it doesn't really matter whether Adam and Eve were real people. It matters that we are real sinners. So it's kind of like taking the story of Pinocchio and thinking, you know, does it matter if Pinocchio was a real boy? No, it matters that we shouldn't lie. If we learn that lesson from that story, that's what matters to us. That's what they would say. But, of course, we've got an answer to that, but that's kind of where he was.
What liberalism really did is boil everything down to ethics.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that is the nature of who we are. We don't want an authority over us, so we just want to build an ethical system that meets our standards, and then we can say we've met it. And I think liberalism, though it may have been defeated, is really the force within us that is always going to fight.
Of course, all those denominations that I pointed out to us earlier, all of those are in decline over a long period of time. The Presbyterian Church USA is a shadow of itself. It's dying.
Yeah.
And all the rest of them are dying too. And what happened is people have gone to other denominations. The Pentecostals have gone way up, mm-hmm. and a lot of people just left the church, period. So, yeah. But, of course, I mean, we can only do what we can do, I guess. But
the battle is never won.
Yeah.
What strikes me is how clever the enemy was in turning believers away from faith in God, because how this is presented, liberalism is really that, like Annie was saying, it's nobody's going to tell me what to do, and there's part of me, part of my human nature that wants to be God, and they gutted the holiness of God, the idea that God is different, is above us, we can't know him, and the revelation of him to us is Jesus, and Jesus is always the stumbling block. When I talk to people, they can handle me saying God sometimes. They cannot handle Jesus. And that's, you know, the liberal is so anti who Jesus is by gutting, like saying he was basically just a good man or whatever, mm-hmm. but not God in the flesh, mm-hmm. not the redemption, that statement that guy made yep. about he thought redemption was the point of the gospel and then systematically denied every reason why it was the redemption.
Denying the meaning of what redemption is, you know. Yeah. So.
But it feels like just that human nature, it feels like the enemy at work. And when I was in college, I loved secular humanism. And I'd grown up a believer. And it's that temptation to be intellectual, to feel like you're smarter. It's very...
Well, I'll just emphasize that. These guys were smart people. They all were. They were not dummies. But as I told my students in Ethiopia, you don't have to be a Christian to be a theologian. There's lots of theologians who are not Christians. They don't believe what the Bible says the way we do. But they're scholars. And, you know, even the foremost Greek lexicon used by anybody who's really a Greek student, that was authored by an Arian. He doesn't believe in the Trinity, but he's a scholar, and he was good. And so?
This reminds me a little bit of a quote that I came across a while ago from Aldous Huxley, who said, it has a strange word in it, but most unbelief is vincible. We don't believe because for one reason or another it benefits us not to. And he went on to explain, if there is a God as revealed in the Bible, that means there's some things I shouldn't do, and that rubs me the wrong way. So.
Yep, it's very true. So, that's why we're here. And how do we connect with people? Well, I think it's best one person at a time, understanding where they're coming from, and then trying to figure out how to speak to them. Of course, it's not something that happens easily, but for most people, I especially think people who become believers as adults, it's partly due to a recognition of a need that they've got. They face a crisis in their life, or something happens, and all of a sudden they realize they're not as independent and self-sufficient as they thought they were. And we all like to be independent and self-sufficient, even if we're Christians. That's why Schleiermacher's statement about sin is failing to be completely dependent on God has such a strong ring of truth to it. That's a temptation for everybody.
It just leaves out who God is.
I'm sorry?
It just leaves out who God is. It leaves out the sin, like the holiness part.
Well, I don't know if he would say God isn't holy. I think it's more how he talks about the different aspects of the Christian doctrine. You know, whether you're talking about resurrection, like Bultmann said, well, the resurrection is obviously false. The second coming is obviously false because Jesus never came back. He said, I'm coming back quickly. He didn't do it. So it's false. So. Okay, well, thank you. If you have any comments to lead me now or later, I'd appreciate them. You could stick your papers on the end there when you walk out.